This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Currently, however, Kevin is in Morocco, where he's attempting to track down one of the alleged suicide hijackers, a man who was quite startled to discover that his name was listed among those who had died on 9/11. If anyone can track him down, I'm confident that Kevin can. During a recent visit I made to New York, I had the pleasure of speaking to a 9/11 truth movement group that was organized by Peggy Carter, the occasion of my giving a presentation. And Peggy is a very articulate woman who has a considerable knowledge of the development of the 9/11 movement in general, and especially in New York. And for that and other reasons, I thought it would be a great idea to have her on as a guest. So it's my pleasure to welcome you, Peggy, to the Dynamic Duo.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Why don't you give us a little bit of information about your background and where you grew up and went to school and things like that, and how you got drawn into the 9/11 movement.
Okay. I was born in Los Angeles, and I went to UCLA and the University of California at Santa Barbara, and I was interested in the study of religion, kind of cross-disciplinary study. And at that time, it's pretty controversial because a lot of people feel that the 9/11 movement itself has been, you know, quote-unquote, infiltrated by cults or whatever. But
hey, don't go too fast now. Where in L.A. were you born?
Talk a little slower. I was born in Santa Monica.
Because I was born in Pasadena, and both of my parents graduated from UCLA.
Oh, wow. Okay, there you go.
Well, that's terrific. And you went to Santa Barbara, did you say?
Well, I became involved with a, you know, Hindu group. I became involved with meditation and yoga when I was very young. And, you know, I studied that, and I you know, practiced yoga for many years. And I became aware that there was a there was a group mind, and there was also a dynamic in the group where people, I guess you might say, it was a kind of mind control issues. So I got out of that group, and I guess I developed a certain, I don't know, awareness of those kind of issues through that and working through that. But I was always interested in sort of asking questions and finding out about things that other people maybe didn't always want to know about. Or, like, well, I grew up in, I went to high school at Beverly Hills High School, and I was surrounded by, well, assimilated Jewish people. And, you know, I ended up just wanting to know about the Jewish religion and ending up knowing more about it than many of my friends. And so that's just been my nature, just to try to, like, curiosity, always being curious and wanting to, you know, ask questions.
Well, when you mentioned this this groupthink or mind control, was that in relation to the yoga group, or was it a different organization or society?
That was in relation to the group I became involved with when I was 17 or 18 years old.
And that was out in L.A. too then?
That's right, uh-huh. And it was interesting how it wasn't apparent initially when you became involved what was really going on. And I think that could be the case with many, quote-unquote, secret societies.
It almost sounds like a description of Scientology.
Right. Our group, in my opinion, wasn't Scientology, I've done quite a bit of study on, and I don't believe that our group was quite as, I don't know what word to say, but it wasn't quite as
extreme.
Heavy. Extreme, yeah. Yeah, but some of the same principles are in operation.
How did you wind up back in New York?
Well, the meditation center was in the countryside, up outside of New York, in an area where there was a lot of hotels, old big hotels that had been abandoned because it became an unfashionable area.
What community was it?
It was called Sullivan County, and it was also commonly known as they called it the Borscht Belt, because it used to be maybe 500 different hotels there, and it was a lot of comics started out there.
Uh-huh.
And it was very popular. It had its heyday in the 50s. And so that area became abandoned, and so the group that I was involved with had a big, you know, center there, because they were able to buy up, you know, two or three hotels.
Did you say when you were in college or graduate school that you were studying religion?
Yes, I studied religion, but as a cross-disciplinary study.
Comparative religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
World religions.
Also, you know, from a psychological point of view, from a historical point of view, it was one of those cross-disciplinary studies like you might have in women's study or black study, you know.
Well, this must have given you some insights about Islam and so forth. I mean, it must have been very strange to you to see Islam portrayed as an aggressive, militant religion intent on killing Christians.
Yes, I think that just growing up where I did and when I did in Los Angeles, I had a different viewpoint toward Christianity, even though I was taught, you know, my ancestors were Christian and we were ostensibly Christian. I think it was, you know, it was quite a watered down Christianity. So
maybe a Unitarian or a Congregationalist or even Episcopalian?
Well, my family was Episcopalian, but my mother was, you know, she was involved with, like, you know, Mary Baker Eddy, like, you know, kind of almost like a New Age kind of religion. That's, I guess, kind of
I had a grandmother
very
who
common.
Was a Christian scientist, and in fact, the one period of my life when I was involved with organized religion in junior high and high school, it was with the Episcopal Church in South Pasadena. But
mm-hmm.
as a professional philosopher who is a student of science and the theory of knowledge, I find, you know, religious beliefs, theological beliefs are untestable, and I embrace the principle of not believing, holding beliefs that I can't justify on the basis of logical grounds. So I am, in fact, an agnostic as opposed to a devotee of any form of religion. I sometimes describe myself as an intellectually an agnostic, but emotionally an atheist in the sense that I don't find a need for a God hypothesis to understand or explain what goes on in the world today.
That's you know, that's pretty close to my point of view. I'm an agnostic as well. It's interesting to me. I think that the religious sentiment is really a desire to know, to desire to have the answers, and there's an inner need. I think there's an inner human need for that, and unfortunately, it's played upon by certain people or certain groups of people who don't have the best interests in mind and who like to dominate others. So the religion becomes a mask of authoritarianism.
So tell me, what brought you down to New York, to the city?
Well, I became aware that the group I was with was, fraudulent, and so I really wanted to stay in New York because my family by that time was here, and
You wanted to stay in New York, the state, and you wound up moving to New York, the city.
Exactly, and just to move within driving distance of my family, I had my mother staying with me there, and she was sick, so. I took care of her. I took care of her, and I lived in the city in order to work, and then I visited up there.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Peggy Carter. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest, Peggy Carter, is active in the 9/11 Truth Movement in New York City, and I thought it would be great to have her on to share her views and experiences. Peggy, you were just telling us about having moved to New York City. Whereabouts did you wind up living, and how did you get drawn into the 9/11 Truth business?
Well, I started... And with, I get anti-Bush, being someone who was, from the very beginning, I followed the election of 2000 very closely, and I understood that the election was not done according to the rule of law, which I think was very upsetting to me. The Supreme Court was corrupted, and they really, at that point, should have been impeached for treason. And I understood the implications from the very beginning of this group that has taken control of the United States. So I did activism along those lines, and I was not one of the first people to understand that the 9/11 was not what it was being promoted to be. That didn't happen until a few years later.
No, I was the same way. It wasn't obvious to me from the beginning. In fact, I was drawn into it by way of the Pentagon, where someone I had collaborated with on JFK research, a photo analyst, legendary, by the name of Jack White, sent me a series of studies he'd done on the Pentagon. And based upon this, that stimulation, I picked up a couple of books by Thierry Meissen entitled Pentagate and 9/11, The Big Lie. And I was convinced that things were completely wrong at the Pentagon. I began putting together pieces and on a website I maintain on public issues, assassinationscience.com, and I kept adding more and more links, mostly related to the Pentagon. But from there, I became more interested in other aspects of the case. And of course, by December of 2005, I was very deeply involved and found myself in the middle of a group of rather talented people and proposed creating a loose affiliation, a society that might sponsor lectures and promote publications and all that sort of thing, and wound up founding Scholars for 9/11 Truth. But, you know, I think for an awful lot of people it's been a gradual dawning, and that what we're doing today is really making converts one at a time, but that the rate at which we're making converts appears to be growing.
I think so, too.
Tell me about your experience in New York then. Where did you gravitate? Was there an extant 9/11 truth group?
Well, I was, like I said, I was involved with studying politics, say current events closely, and I was somehow, I would, go to different venue and different lecture series and things like that, and there was a, in late 2004, there was an all-day event at Symphony Space, and they had different researchers from all over in Canada and California, and it was all day. It was maybe 8 to 10 hours, and when I understood from that what the situation was, I think I caught up rather quickly. Initially, the thing that had caught my eye was the clip of Building 7 collapsing. I had heard other people say that the fire wasn't hot enough to take down the building, and I had dismissed that. But when I saw the Building 7 collapsing at the unnatural speed, I think I grasped the implication of that immediately.
Yes, yes. It's an absolutely classic controlled demolition, a complete abrupt and total collapse at freefall speed into its own foundation. Usually that characteristic kink where one of the major support columns has been taken out, so it'll collapse inward rather than outward. Even notables like Dan Rather and Peter Jennings, who were there at the scene observing it, described it as just like the controlled demolitions of those casinos and resorts we've seen so many times in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not an expert on building demolitions. I know very little about it, but I don't think you need to know a lot about it to know that there's something unnatural about the way the building comes down.
Well, it had only very modest fires, of course, few and far between, which for whatever reason hadn't been battled. They could have been easily extinguished. It was hit by no aircraft, and of course it had no jet-based fuel fires, so the whole thing was completely anomalous. Till we discover, of course, that Larry Silverstein explains he has had a conversation with your fire commander, and that verbal pause suggests to me he knew this guy under a different designation, and he tells him, there's been so much death and devastation, perhaps the best thing to do is to pull it. And they make the decision to pull, and they watch the building come down. Several points follow, of course. You can't pull the building or bring it down unless there are previously positioned explosives, which, if that's true of Building 7, raises the possibility it was true of Buildings 1 and 2 as well. And second of all, if you're concerned about there having been a lot of devastation, how can you minimize that by bringing about even more devastation through the destruction, deliberate destruction of yet another building? In fact, that building, as you may well know, Peggy, was extremely robust in its construction. It was erected over two enormous electrical generators providing power to lower Manhattan. I think it was designed to never collapse. The steel in those columns was, the support columns were all solid steel, even more massive than the hollowed out support columns that were used in constructing the North and the South Towers.
I think that one thing was the brazenness of it, just the in your face. It's just very blatantly anomalous. And I think that this kind of in-your-face quality was also present with the, in, at least from my experience, from everything that had been going on since, 2000. Some may argue, of course, the plotting and the planning for this and the kind of government that we have had been doing things from before 2000, but I think they, I don't know, somehow, for me anyway, they became more brazen after that.
I think you're absolutely right. The theft of the election in 2000, the massive tax cuts for the rich based on telescoping of surpluses. Clinton put us on a trajectory for massive surpluses in the future, and Bush treated them as though it was already money on hand, as though we could give away a trillion here and a trillion there and still expect that money to be around 10 or 15 years hence. The idea of pulling out of the Kyoto Accords or in the face of global warming, which may lead to yet to the extinction of the entire human species, not to mention all the phony reasons for going to war in Iraq. All of this was very much in your face. I mean, they have utter contempt for the citizens of this nation, for due process, for respect for treaties or the Constitution. It's truly shocking. And, you know, Peggy, for this nation to now be the greatest aggressor nation in the world, having launched two wars in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution is simply appalling. I mean, we have gone from the most admired and respected nation in the world to the most despised and reviled.
Have been proven time and time again.
I'm also concerned about the Military's Commissions Act and the rescinding of habeas corpus.
Yeah, Peggy, we'll come right back to it. We didn't get our warning music, so we'll just stick out until we left off. Thanks a lot. My special guest today is Peggy Carter from the 9/11 Truth Movement in New York City. Peggy, before the end of our last segment, I was talking about some of the reasons why the Bush administration has been so much in our face, including, of course, the massive tax cuts for the rich after stealing the election in Florida with the compliance of the Supreme Court, withdrawing from global warming, the Kyoto Accords, which was outrageous and actually places in jeopardy the entire human species, all of the phony reasons for going to war in Iraq. And, of course, you were talking, you wanted to bring up some domestic issues. Please do add them to the list.
Well, the 9/11 was a pretext to bring in a permanent war, to program the state of permanent war, and it was key for plans to develop a police state. So in terms of the domestic front of the war, is that we lose our rights and we lose our even our ability to organize. In New York City, they're starting to make rules about how many people can gather. People are not allowed to have bullhorns if you're talking about a political subject or if you're talking about a religious subject or even advertising, you can. So,
this is very, very bad. I mean, we're seeing a suppression of our freedom of speech on all sides.
Well, I think that one thing is, it doesn't seem so terrible on the surface, and I think the reason that that's part of the strategy is in order that people not be alarmed and not mobilize. And so a lot of it is very surreptitious and it isn't brought to people's attention. For instance, the Military Commissions Act and the Anti-Terrorism Act was in the late 90s, but what this does is it actually puts us legally into a police state, and people don't realize that. They talk about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, but they don't realize the number one right is the right not to be imprisoned without a recourse to a hearing before a judge and without a recourse to being told why you're being arrested. And now Bush has been, the executive branch of the government now in the United States has been given that power by Congress. Most people don't realize that. Most people don't realize we no longer officially live in a democracy anymore. We're living in a police state. And as long as people don't realize that, they can, they're not mobilized. They're not in a position to try to change it or do anything about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And in the JFK assassination, there was a parallel where they brought the limousine, they changed the motorcade route and brought the limousine up Houston and then turned onto Elm Street, 110-degree turn, which was in violation of Secret Service policies, but the point was to slow it down without alarming the passengers so they could bring them into a kill zone at a very low rate of speed where Jack would be more likely to be hit by the multiple assassins that were awaiting him. So it's very analogous psychologically, doing terrible things in a fashion that won't alarm people so that they don't really appreciate how serious or grave is the situation.
Mm-hmm. And it's it is frightening, but it's frightening, but it's also difficult to communicate that to people because of the way people are conditioned by, you know, watching, I guess, an average American 7 hours of TV a day or however people have been conditioned.
You know, the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld announced to Congress that the Pentagon had lost track of $2.3 trillion. And I've often wondered what happened to all that money, and it has seemed to me one possibility is that it was being used to gain control of different media assets. I mean, there are a lot of possibilities here. That's a whole lot of money and a whole lot of motive for a whole lot of despicable acts. But the media, I mean, our founding fathers would just be appalled that the newspapers of our nation aren't performing their historic task of being critics of the government and informing the people about irresponsible government actions. They function much more as apologists and communicators of whatever the government wants us to hear from its own point of view with its own spin. It's a disgusting situation.
With the research I've been, you know, doing with a group, a relatively small group about the TV fakery and the video fakery, it's even deeper than just cover up. I think they're actually working with the perpetrators. And a lot of evidence is coming up all the time. Even in the past week, we're finding more and more videos that have been, obviously, they were, you know, manipulated. And so the problem is to get outside of the media because everyone, that's what their information source is, and they've been brought up with the television, the people on television, you know, the people on TV are their friends. They really think they know who these people and that somehow they think the television is their friend. And so my goal in the 9/11 activism has been to try to spread the information, because I believe that if people were aware of what was going on, then we would be in a much better position. We would be, you know, even without addressing where we want to go from here, just if people were aware of the situation, I believe we would be much safer.
And, of course, the most blatant discovery or act of that kind in suggesting media complicity with the government on 9/11 was the BBC footage discovered in the archives where the reporter at 4:57 is explaining how Building 7 has collapsed 23 minutes before the event would occur, and over her left-hand shoulder you can actually see Building 7 in the background.
And there's one of our researchers, his name is BS Registration, you know, Bullshit Registration, or Fred. He has actually been able to make the case that the newscasters were reading from scripts. And at the moment when the quote-unquote whatever, you know, explosion on the South Tower occurred, they all, you know, said the same two or three lines.
These are on different stations. They were all saying the same two or three lines on ABC, NBC, CBS,
mm-hmm.
and local New York affiliates.
And they knew exactly what to say at that moment. And you can, there's one station where apparently they either didn't have the script or weren't prompted or cued correctly, and they have what would I consider a more normal response, which is when something happens, it's very startling. Usually you're quiet for a few moments, or, you know, just because you're absorbing what happened.
Yeah.
And he was able to show that they were even the timing, or excuse me, there is also someone that was also researching, and his name is Andrew Watson. He's from England. He's a composer. And he was also analyzing the audio. And he was pointing out that they were able to say, oh, my God, I mean, at the exact moment that the explosion erupted, in other words, there was no lag between the explosion and then saying, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And so
No need to process the information. You already knew in advance what information you needed to process.
Mm-hmm. And he's also shown that some of these voices are the same voices. And,
really?
So in other words, it would have been done in a recording studio. But if you want...
Stand by, Peggy. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer with my special guest, Peggy Carter from New York. We'll be right back on The Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Peggy Carter, a 9/11 truth activist from New York City. Peggy, would I be correct to infer from the link you sent that there's some areas of 9/11 research you'd like to discuss in relation to that, what we could find on the Internet?
Yes, I put some links up. The site's called 911researchlinks.blogspot.com.
So if we go to 911researchlinks.blogspot.com, then you'll take us through some areas of research.
Right. And I wanted to mention that recently, in the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of activity, and the group of researchers in this aspect of the 9/11 study has been growing very, very rapidly. And we've just had certain insights, and one of them is that the military was developing something called Future Combat Systems, which was an integration of media and the, you know, theater of war. And we believe this might have been some type of testing for that system. And that system is a model for what they were doing, because they were also controlling the information.
Where in fact information is regarded as a weapon of war, that they want to control the dissemination of information as much as they do the deployment of ordinary weapons in space, on land and sea.
Yes, and if you think about it, including with the JFK assassination, the job itself was done in a sloppy manner. I mean, and people would use that to argue, well, if it was really the case, then how come they did it so sloppy? And that's, I guess you could point out how that's so illogical. Because obviously if someone does something poorly, it's not a sign that they didn't do it at all. But the point is that the biggest thing was the molding of public opinion, and being able to keep people from looking at it, and the psychological warfare aspect of it, that probably even more money was spent on that aspect on it than the actual operation itself, in my opinion.
Well, that might well be right. Certainly in JFK, the stories were being broadcast from Dallas immediately that there had been three shots, for example. The acoustics in Dallas are very complicated. There couldn't have been any assurance that there had been only three shots. In fact, other persons, other parties who were present, and there were hundreds of witnesses in Dealey Plaza, were reporting larger numbers of shots, up to six or seven. In fact, our research shows that Jack himself was hit four different times, from in front and from behind. Big John Connolly, as many as one to three from the side. And there were three other shots that missed. There were actually eight, nine, or ten shots, which appear to have been fired from six different directions. My opinion is that one of those locations, which was the second floor of the Dow Tech building, which provided an ideal shooting location very much on the horizontal with a target, may have been the only done with an unsilenced weapon, which I believe was probably a Mannlicher Carcano, in order to try to implicate this obscure World War II weapon that would then be associated with Lee Oswald. But your point is impeccable. Controlling the information and subsequently the body and what information was disseminated to the American people was essential in the relation of JFK, just as I would say you're right that it was essential, too, in relation to 9/11.
You mentioned before the amount of money that had been gone missing from the Pentagon. So you can imagine the money that these people have at their disposal. So it isn't, a great leap of the imagination to think that they would be able to train people, polish speakers, they would be able to have writers, resources to publish books, and everything with the intention of making sure that people didn't become sensitized and use this event to sort of blow the whole, game for them.
I think you're correct, and they're using taxpayer dollars to enslave the nation. This is one of the ironies that must give them great satisfaction, but is appalling if you understand what's actually going on. Would you like to review, then, some of the information you have on your site here?
Sure, I'd love to. And on the first picture, I don't know if people have trouble loading the photograph, but it's a photograph in Times Square, and we've got our banner up there, 9/11 was an inside job. And the picture is meant to show the sort of lack of parity, or the imbalance between the media that's being funded by the people that run the world, as compared to 9/11 research people who are just
you look around Times Square and you see all the huge banners. I mean, the advertisements, the glowing, blinking lights, all kinds of fantastic stuff, and you have this little banner. Quite a contrast.
So that's it. That's where we are.
Continue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there is a few things that were just people just, in fact, I'm thinking of the names now. There's a whole group of names of people that are kind of networking with each other.
Yeah.
I have them actually there. Web Fairy, BS Registration, Still Digging, Kill Town,
yeah.
Nico and all that. And so they've just come up with this idea that there was actually with this this future combat systems, they had cameras, they had different cameras, and they were actually manipulating the views, all the different views, and using blurred shots, so that actually what went on down there that day, we don't really know. And
yeah.
I think the analogy is also with what you said before about, what you've said about the JFK, that it's hard to know exactly what really did happen. Because
in that case, they took this, they used a whole movie of the assassination to create the image they wanted to convey of what had happened. They contracted the time sequence. They eliminated some crucial events, such as a driver pulling the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure Jack would be killed, and he was hit twice in the head during that brief interval. And they did it in a very sophisticated way, using the techniques of optical print and special effects, which is one reason why I've always been open-minded about the possibility that there could have been video fakery here. You have some clips I think you'd like us to look at. Is that right, the first one here?
Yes, so I just wanted to frame the idea. So the idea that was come upon just in the last couple of weeks, or the last week really, by Fred, BS Registration, who's been doing a lot of the video analysis, was that the actual shots, many of them, were created with some type of software, computer software, where they're layering different shots, so that the actual image is of something that couldn't or doesn't exist. He gave the analogy of sort of having a safe, like somebody's doing safe cracking, so they'll have a picture of a safe that they put out, like in a cartoon, they put the picture of a safe out, and then behind that they're cracking the safe. So here they're putting out a picture of what's going on, and behind that they're doing whatever they're doing, and that would include the pictures that Judy Wood has presented and has brought to everyone's attention, showing the kind of strange damage that's going on.
Should we take up look at the incredible moving bridge on 9/11?
Mm-hmm. Right. And so in this one you can see see if mine's going to work. You can see that you're pulling out, and you're pulling out from a view of the Twin Towers looking from the north, and you have the feeling that you're moving around them. In other words, you're moving in a circle around them, but actually the view of the Twin Towers doesn't change. But this bridge behind, which is the Verrazano Bridge, is basically, floating in space. And this bridge is actually quite distant. It's 7.5 miles away. So we haven't had time to actually do the trigonometry.
But you have an incredible moving bridge. That's really quite fascinating. This is Jim Fetta with my special guest, Peggy Carter, from 9/11 Truth in New York. We'll be right back. Stand by. This is the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetta, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Currently, however, Kevin is in Morocco seeking to track down one of those alleged suicide bombers who was rather astonished to discover that he'd been killed on 9/11. If anyone can do it, the boy wonder is the guy. I'm here today with my special guest, Peggy Carter, from the 9/11 Truth Movement in New York City. and we're reviewing research results on a link she created for this purpose, 911researchlinks.blogspot.com. And I must say, Peggy, now that I see what you have here, there's a staggering amount of information. I'm very glad we're starting with these video clips. The first, of course, is dramatic evidence of fake video, because you're looking at a tower from exactly the same perspective. You're backing up, which should make features in the background, for example, smaller, but instead we're watching the bridge move across the screen, which is a startling result. It cannot be a genuine phenomenon, but has to be reflective of video fakery. And I've gone ahead and taken a peek at the spinning WTC, and that's equally imposing. Why don't we play it, Peggy, and you can describe what you have there.
All right. Well, I just want to talk a little bit about the bridge for just one moment. There might be listeners who don't have the advantage of having a computer and seeing what's going on. The idea is that there's layers, and so there's a layer in front that has the twin towers that are burning. And there's a layer behind that is having the horizontal bridge. And so there's some type of video artists that are putting these layers together. And sometimes you can see the seams. And this is a time where you can see the seams. In other words, the two different layers don't mesh.
Are you talking about the darker and lighter in the vision? Well, but it's got to be the foreground and background, right? Because it's the bridge that's moving, and we have a consistent vision of the towers themselves.
Right, I'm just saying seams in a metaphorical way. In other words, you can see the cracks in their illusion.
Right,
here.
In this case, you have the bridge moving when the bridge ought to be roughly stationary and only diminishing in size as the camera moves back.
Yes, and also there is the question that this bridge is too large for where you're looking from.
Yes.
The bridge is 7.5 miles away, and if you see it on the ground from the tip of Manhattan, it's tiny.
Yes.
And so this would have to be worked out, you know, in Still Diggin is one of our researchers that does the trigonometry and the mathematics,
yep.
And it could be worked out where you could really demonstrate it, but just from a gut feeling, you can see that there's a sense that this is not an authentic.
I'd say Bridger might be about a mile away max. I mean, you know, all things considered in terms of perspective, maybe even it would have to be closer. But that's a great point. That's very nice.
Okay, and then also you can also see in this video, there's what a lot of people have pointed out and noticed is that there are these orbs or these anomalies. They're UAVs, and you can see that off to the right in the to the tower, this little black dot that's moving. Well, these little objects are really swarming around in different, you can catch them in different clips.
Okay.
And the idea is that we theorize that these are unmanned aviation vehicles that are cloaked. And we even have pictures, because in the public domain there are pictures of these military devices.
So these do not appear to be helicopters, such as, for example, Rick Siegel has captured in his video, 9/11 Eyewitness.
That's true. This one, it's floating. It looks to be at a distance. The helicopters were clustered closer. But, I mean, this is just one example. There's pages. There's a man named Chris Bornack, and I believe I have links to his collection on YouTube. Or there's clip after clip after clip that shows these anomalies, or you know whatever we believe that they're actually
anomalies is a good word.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the next one is also it's an odd one, because you seem to have the layers also coming detached from each other.
Right. What you have here is, it's as though you had a plane flying around the World Trade Center, except that the whole time you've got exactly the same perspective on the World Trade Center, and yet the background is moving, which would only be physically possible if the World Trade Center itself were rotating. Hence, you have the spinning World Trade Center. I mean, this is a fascinating one to watch.
Yeah, this also was just discovered. I mean, this all has just been happening in the past week, where people have been going over archives and going over footage and noticing this, because I guess it's almost like a paradigm shift when all of a sudden you discover something and you notice it all around?
Yes.
This is something
like it occurred when we discovered the autopsy x-rays in the case of JFK had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head in one case, and by adding a 6.5 millimeter metallic slice in the case of another. Once you realize that the depth of the deception, it becomes effortless to look at the autopsy photographs and to realize that they're faked. It turns out most of the evidence in the case of JFK, not just some, but most of it is faked. And that's the impression I'm getting now, is that it's possible that most of the photographic evidence that was run over television on 9/11 was faked.
Okay, and at the end of this, you can see the Empire State Building, which also seems grossly out of scale.
Good.
And to the right of the screen.
Good, very, very good. By the way, let me say, you have so much here. Would you like to go through everything you have here if you had enough time? I mean, we obviously don't today. We're going through some of these videos, which is perfect. But would you like to come back, Peggy, and discuss some of these other content you have here?
Yes, I would be, I'd be honored to share that with you, Jim.
Well, let's plan to do that already on the 30th. That's 2 weeks from today, Peggy. I'm going to mark you down for the 30th. We'll repeat this 2 weeks from now, so I don't want you to worry about not being able to cover everything. You got a lot of stuff here. You've obviously put a lot of time into putting this together, and I want us to have the chance to appreciate it. So, if you want to spend more time on anything in particular, just know you've got the time.
Okay, and this particular set of, videos that I put up for this show, I just did this afternoon, so there's typos and mistakes.
Fine.
And as far as also the research links, that's something I just did a couple days ago, so there's a lot of typos and
You can tidy it all up if you want for
that's
the
30th. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm
going to
do. That's what I'll do.
Don't worry about that now. Go ahead. Just go ahead.
Okay. There is something called the people that have been researching this, like Webb Ferry and Nico Haupt, have named Evan Fairbanks. And the reason they named it that is because that's the man who is alleged to have taken the shot, or believed to have. Anyway, he was interviewed by ABC News and as the cameraman for this particular shot.
Okay.
And for a long time, there's a couple things that are strange about it, but in some of the clips and some of the examples of this shot, there's a monitor, and there was an argument because it wasn't clear whether it was a monitor that shows up in the frame or whether it was a reflection off of something.
Should we look at something here?
Yes, the problem is this was uploaded, and you can look at it because what I did was
This is what you can do, Peggy. We got a break. Why don't you check out which one of these you'd like us to look at, or if there's more than one, in which order. And we'll be right back with my special guest, Peggy Carter. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Peggy Carter from 9/11 Truth in New York, and we're going through some research results of Peggy and her collaborators, which are found on 9/11researchlinks.blogspot.com. And we're going to continue this discussion 2 weeks hence on the 30th. So the fact that we're not going to be able to get through all this is something we're going to continue at that time. Peggy, what should we look at now?
All right. I just put up a link because one of the people in our group, his name is Still Diggin, and he's done some of the best research, mathematical, geometrical, and his sister taped the day on a VHS tape, and he took it and he copied it, and he found an example of this Evan Fairbanks, and this was what we call the Evan Fairbanks clip, just in the past few days.
Yeah.
Now, we tried to upload it, but it's coming out upside down on when we put it up to live video. And now I have the link.
Is the one you added Peculiar Reflections?
Peculiar Reflections is a Web Theory put up a GIF, where you can see the what we're talking about. We're talking about the monitor, which is
What should we look at then? You tell us.
Okay, you can if you want it, at some time at your leisure, you can click on where it says ABC News Evan Fairbanks or ABC News Fairbanks, and then you can download the AVI, which is, you know,
okay.
You download it and save it, and then you can play it on your real
All
player.
Right.
And if you look at the Peculiar Reflections, if you click on that, you can see...
Should we do that right now?
Yes, please.
Okay.
And hopefully you can see the GIF in the upper right. And in this you can see the what it looks like. In this, it's hard to tell if it's a reflection or if it's a monitor. In the better quality VHS, a copy from the VHS that we just got in the last few days, you can see that that's actually a monitor. And the interesting thing is that the monitor does not match what is ostensibly happening in real time.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, okay, so you know the monitor isn't...
I see the monitor, and I see what appears to be a reflection of a plane in the monitor.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, and so in order to see, in order to see the full clip, let me see if I put it up. I think I might have put it up on my links, but...
Which is okay, Peggy, because we can always come back to it. You can overhaul what you want to go through, you know, for 2 weeks hence.
Exactly.
We'll just spend the whole show on all these things. So, I mean, the fact that we got the idea here, this is very curious.
And there's, if you click on catching the world in the, catching the world in the process of change, or...
Is that on this page, or do I go back to
it? It's right, it's underneath. The link is underneath. It's catching the world in the act of changing. It should be underneath.
Are we on Peculiar Reflection?
Yes. You're not seeing it. Maybe if you refresh. Yes.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
No, I still don't have it. So that's okay. Why don't we go back to the other site and do some more look at some more footage.
Okay.
So a past Peculiar Reflections. What should we look at next?
Okay, let me. I have to get back there myself. Oh, well, there's. Do you see where it says questions to ask Evan Fairbanks?
Yes.
Okay, and so this, if you click on that.
Okay, I'm clicking on it.
Evan Fairbanks gave an interview on ABC News, and part of that is there's a text, a story.
Did he answer all those questions?
No, these are the questions that need to be asked of him.
Okay.
And maybe, you know, and some of them. And
is there suspicion that Evan Fairbanks might have been involved since he had this monitor?
Well, he needs to answer some questions because, according to his story, he had his own camera, but somebody handed him another camera, and that's the camera that he used. So there's a question of why is it that he was handed another camera?
That it was as though it were a better camera or better for whatever purpose. Okay, that's interesting. Go ahead.
And the idea would be that perhaps what he had in his hand was not really a camera, but it was actually a kind of a monitor.
All right.
So when he looked through it, he thought he was taking a photograph when actually he wasn't.
All right.
But he said afterwards that he did not know what was in it until he saw it.
Right. He might have been visually just looking at the playback of a film already exposed and developed.
Exactly. And the event occurred so quickly, quote-unquote event.
Yeah.
So he may not have been looking up when it happened.
Right.
And also, so we need to ask him as well if he heard something. You know,
okay.
If you heard an airplane such like that.
Go ahead.
So,
we go back then to the...
Yes, please.
All right.
Now, this...
That's catching the world in the act of changing, by the way.
It's underneath article in Evan's...
Uh-huh.
Survey. Yeah, that's the one I was mentioning.
Should I click that?
Yes, sure.
Okay. Oh, here's Evan Fairbanks. I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Boxer, catching the world in the act of changing.
Mm-hmm. So you can see that the plane in this, the quote-unquote plane in this clip, performs something that is illogical because it doesn't slow down, and we know according to Newton's first law, an object, an inertial object, you know, it will continue unless a force stops it. So the fact that it's not slowing down, it's implied that there's no force stopping it, as well, it doesn't break up. It stays totally intact as it enters the building. And Newton's third law is that a force exerted when two objects hit. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But from the look of the plane, the way it enters the building, there's no equal and opposite reaction upon the plane.
If I had to interpret that here, I think it would mean that the force of the plane hitting the building would be the same as the force of the building hitting the plane.
Mm-hmm.
That they're going to be equal and opposite. But, of course, the building of enormous mass is going to require, it's not the force will be equal to this very small mass at high speed. So I don't know
right.
if that one gives us a lot of interpretive leverage. But anyway, I'm glad you bring it up.
The idea is that we know it to be a cartoon image because of the way the plane disappears into the building.
Okay, this is Jim Fetzer with my special guest Peggy Carter. You're listening to the Dynamic Duo, and we'll be right back. Today, my special guest Peggy Carter from 9/11 Truth Movement in New York City, and we're going through some video studies, especially a video fakery on 9/11researchlinks.blogspot.com. Peggy, where shall we pick up?
Well, I'd like to show this Whitehall. It's
okay, Whitehall overlay.
Yes, if you play the clip, you'll see the this is the primary source. This was aired on CNN as an exclusive. And it's just, the NIST report declared that the person who took that is named Michael Herxorian. But, as far as being able to find this person, identify them, or we haven't been able to do that. As far as was he awarded, money in the same way as the Pruner was for this would be worth a $1 million shot. And exactly how he got it or where he was standing, all of that was obscure.
And you're talking about when you locate the video footage in relation to the actual physical geography of the scene, you find the trees were much bigger at the actual scene than they're shown in the video.
Yes, I went down there. I was talking about the video that was embedded in the 9/11 Research Links blogspot. I thought you might look at that first.
Yeah.
In order to see the primary,
I'll go back.
We're talking about. But yes, I went down there because.
But that's the Whitehall ghost plane spot versus present spot overlay, right?
Yes, I went down there in February because there was we looked at this video and we thought that the proportion of the buildings didn't look correct because the top of the Trade Center is it seems as though you're standing on the ground and that the top of the Trade Center really isn't very high, and the top of the trees is even almost in scale to the Trade Center, but it just didn't look. There's something about
right.
it that didn't look right. So
it's not plain for me, Peggy. I hope maybe it's plain for everybody else.
Oh,
it's not plain
okay.
for me.
Oh, well.
But we'll be able to catch it next time.
Mm-hmm.
But just by going to the stationary, the static photos, which I can reach, I can see
mm-hmm.
the point.
Yeah, so I went down there, and it turns out if you click where it says the pictures on your blog from February 4th, which is right at the top above the first photo, I don't know
uh-huh.
if you can see that. You can see the pictures I took when I went down there in February, and you can see the first picture where it says Whitehall Building seen from Battery
Park. Oh, the pictures are constantly changing. Yeah, very good.
You can see that the CNN shot, the CNN exclusive shot, was extremely cropped and extremely zoomed.
When were the pictures of the naked trees taken?
That was taken in February, and that was taken from the spot where, there's only one spot that the shot could be taken from.
But February of which year?
This year.
Mm-hmm. So it is a couple of years later.
Yeah, the idea would be that some people might argue that the trees could have grown. I spoke to people that work down there at Clinton Fort, that low brick building that you see on the left.
Yeah.
Because it is Clinton Fort, and they told me that those trees had been there since before 9/11, and that they had been that large. It's anecdotal, but they're sycamore trees, and they maybe grow a couple of feet a year.
Uh-huh.
But there are other problems with this.
Let me just draw the inference. So you're suggesting that the trees actually were much larger on 9/11 than they're shown to be in the video clips.
Yes, in other words, in order for that shot to have been taken where it must have been taken because it, for the perspective to be correct, there was gigantic trees blocking the way.
And what happened to the lamppost?
Well, that's the other thing. There's a bit of an argument about the lamppost because the lampposts were in the park before then, but whether there was one in that exact spot is another question because that area has been... they've done some landscaping there. They put in a park to the right, and it may have been that pole wasn't there, but the trees were there because I spoke to also vendors, and they said that those trees were protected. They were mature trees so that they were protected when they were doing the construction for the memorial park.
Okay. What do you think would be the rationale for doing it this way, using the older foreground? See, this could be optical printing, using an old foreground with a new background. The foreground could include the buildings, of course, and the background being introducing the Twin Towers.
Well,
in other words, the kind of techniques that were used on the Zapruder film could have been used here, it would seem to me.
I think that, well, the Twin Towers were there, so they probably, you know, I'm sure they used, the photograph, whatever that they used, was when they were there.
This is only a still shot, is that right? This isn't actually part of a video?
That's right. We've taken videos, and BS Registration has done a lot of a lot of videos.
Good.
And
good.
He's done some kinds of what they call video mashups, which are kind of little art pieces.
Okay. Do you want more on Whitehall?
That's good. I think that's fine for now. Just the idea that this is the solution to it is the idea that there was different layers that were taken at different times,
right.
So that the picture, the video was actually a composite.
Right.
And there was a man from Sweden who corresponded with me who had been a graphic editor and had worked in this field, and he told me that they use plates. And he said, where you were standing must have been where the plate was taken.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What about the audio analysis then? Should we watch audio proof and no planes here, or watch the live video?
I think that the audio is something that you can watch yourself because it's a little bit of an instruction.
Okay.
But we might want to look at some of these. At the end, I have something called Selections of Artwork 9/11 Mashups.
Okay.
And I think the screw loose people who are the debunkers are saying that they're calling this kind of a 9/11 spawned artwork. So that there's many people that are involved with this kind of creation of these videos that are mixed almost like a music video.
Okay.
And they're informational, but they use these clips from the mainstream media of 9/11.
What should we click?
Well, if you want to do the first one, you can do the mind control cartoon physics.
So I should go to selections of artwork, 9/11 mashups.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm there.
And I guess the one that you saw a week ago when Rosalie was on your show of the gold finger and then showing her enhanced version of the...
The Nade Brothers?
Mm-hmm. That's an example.
Should I play this?
Yes. There's been a flourishing of these, and they've kind of ricocheted around MySpace. I send them out to MySpace friends, and people send them on, and they're kind of becoming a way of spreading information because people, in general, do not read much anymore.
For some reason, Peggy, that's not playing for me either. Dylan Avery has no balls?
That's actually the name of it, of this video.
Where do you want me to go now?
Yeah, this is it. And this one, they did something or other where whoever did it, he's very famous among the 9/11 researchers. His name is Genghis. He's from Australia. And somehow or another, he was able to morph people's lips to make sure, to make them sound as though they're saying something that you obviously know they couldn't have been saying.
Huh.
But I think he's using he's using advanced technology to sort of make a cartoon that looks like real talking heads talking about the cartoon crash physics of 9/11.
Okay, stand by. We'll be right back with Peggy Carter, my special guest. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today we have my special guest, Peggy Carter, from 9/11 Truth in New York, and we're looking at a lot of evidence of video fakery. And Peggy, in this case, I was able to hit your selections of artwork and get the Nade Brothers audio fakery to work. So it appears that the coordination of the sound with the video appears to be fake because of the distance from which the video was taken and the fact that the sound appears to be concurrent with the crash. And what would you like us to look at during this last segment before we come back 2 weeks hence to review all of the bidding?
Well, I think that the Andrews is very interesting because it's using the auditory information, and some people get something if it's, you know, visual. Some people get something if it's auditory, if it's, you know, if they hear it. He's a composer and a very well-known composer in England, and he was able to show that the way this Nade video was released at different times for different specials. And every time it was released, it seemed as though the audio became more and more convincing.
So are we talking about the very footage that I was just looking at?
I think was it called Audio Proof of No Planes Theory?
Audio Fakery at the WTC Part 2 Witnesses, I think.
Okay. Well, the Witnesses shows the part that I spoke about in the beginning of the show where I said that Andrew analyzed the witnesses and showed that they reacted. This is part of what he did. He showed that they were reacting before they even had a real chance to see what was happening. So that's pretty much of an indication that it was the audio was most
likely.
This
is a nearly 9-minute thing, and it starts off with Nade Brothers, and then it goes over Nade Brothers again and explains how, in relation to the distance, that the sound shouldn't be so immediately present. I'm wondering if, you know, was this, well, this is, of course, Nade Brothers footage.
Excuse me?
This is the Nade Brothers footage, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right, and in different times it was released, in different venues or, you know, different versions of it, the audio is different. So, in other words, the audio is changing all the time.
Yeah.
So that shows that, you know, there's some kind of problem with authenticity. People are adding in audio to, I guess, make it more dramatic.
Interesting. What else would you like us to look at while we have time today?
Well, that was what I wanted to show, was this, that, and then I wanted just to say briefly about the, you know, about the politics issue of the local politics here, is that it makes sense that whoever, you know, the perpetrators, the people that organized this, which is, you know, the 9/11 event, which was, you know, I believe it was a military operation. A lot was at stake. A lot of money was at stake. A lot of, you know, it was a huge crime. So there's that level, too. People really want to make sure they're going to get away with it. So I think that the idea that they would try to control the opposition, or that there would be some attempt to do that, I don't think it's far-fetched. I spoke to a friend of mine who's a much long-time activist in New York City than I am, and he explained that what he's seen happen in many political movements here over the years is that the opposition is co-opted. And, you know, the way this also, like I said before, is a way in which the tension isn't drawn, so people really feel that we're not really living in an oppressive society.
Because
it isn't a heavy, you know, oppression where they're grabbing people.
Yeah.
And so this has been the methodology, and I think that that does go on.
Let me mention two ways in which it seems to me this can happen. One is to have a very active research program within a very narrow scope, such as an intensive investigation of thermite, and no tolerance for anyone who gets outside of that range, which I have seen in spades, of course, in relation to the work that Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds have been conducting, and where I've simply been inviting attention to the importance of, if we want to explain everything that happened, the hard evidence is overwhelming that it includes effects that don't appear to have any kind of likelihood of explanation on the basis of thermite or thermate. In fact, I've now been looking at the thermite and thermate business and find that the evidence for the use of thermite and thermate appears to be extremely thin, if not virtually non-existent. So this bothers me tremendously. But that's one way to kind of channel research into a narrow direction and then be very active in relation to that direction, so it looks as though there's a lot of research going on. but then be brutal to those who go outside. I mean, if you go to the 9/11, the Journal of 9/11 Studies now, you'll see it's been turned into a kind of attack machine to defend the thermite-thermate hypothesis and to viciously savage anyone who departs from it, which is completely unscientific. It's authoritarian, and it's not in the interest of truth. So I believe that's what's going on in one dimension of all of this. Another, Peggy, I would suggest, which may fit your situation, is to have a research movement that is relatively passive and innocuous. Well, for example, mm-hmm. you might have meetings, even on a regular basis, where you watch videos but don't have discussion, organize events, or activist, activities that could actually make a difference, achieve some kind of publicity for the movement. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but it has seemed to me that while New York ought to be the center for activism in relation to 9/11, that basically it looks to me through some set of circumstances that that hasn't happened because there's been a program of, as it were, pacification, having meetings where all you do is watch videos and you don't even have discussions, much less invite speakers who might stir up the pot to present, whatever they might have to say to your group. Does that at all sound familiar?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the techniques of controlling the opposition, is to having, the leaders lead you sort of into ineffectiveness or into limbo. And then, in a sense, you may not even be aware that, hey, I'm, you think you're doing something, but it's more like a ritualistic act. And I think it's not just, I don't think we can just blame the 9/11 activists here in New York City. I think it's something that's endemic to the entire culture. I mean, people feel that if they go to a conference that they're doing something.
Yeah.
This is their way of doing it. Everything is sort of simulacrum. It's a simulation of something. It's one step removed from actually doing anything. And then, of course, if you plan to do something, then you're labeled as violent and you're marginalized and you're really, a lot of hatred is directed towards you.
Yeah, I'm beginning to surmise that at least as much time was spent planning how to contain investigation and research into 9/11 as was actually spent planning the event itself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It was quite fascinating. The stuff you're producing is terrific stuff, Peggy, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate the time and effort you've devoted to this. So what I suggest, for our next go-round, where I have you scheduled for the 30th now, is to just rework what you want to present, make sure all the links work, and we'll just systematically go through it. We'll just start at the top and move through it. We won't need to, we won't spend any time reviewing your history and how you got to New York and all that. We'll just go directly through all the evidence you want to present about audio fakery, video fakery, and everything else you want to present, because it looks to me like there's a tremendous amount of information on your website, and I want us to take full advantage of it.
Okay, well, I appreciate the opportunity to do that. And I also wanted to mention that, many in our group, myself included, have been banned from the Loose Change Forum because Dylan Avery has zero tolerance for any kind of evidence or discussion of the, issues of TV fakery.
What's going on there? I don't get it. Dylan has seemed to me to be a reasonable guy, but maybe he's been co-opted by... even Alex Jones is showing a gross intolerance, and Alex doesn't seem to me to have the scientific background, but he seems to be very much under the influence of Steve Jones, so that the Jones twins seem to me to be doing a lot of damage.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Peggy, this will continue this. I look forward to it. Thank you for coming on the show. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. You've been listening to The Dynamic Duo.